Hey everybody, Marcus here. Thank you so much for the fantastic response we got on the first episode of No Dogs in Space. Here, for your consideration, is the second episode, just in case you haven't checked it out yet. Of course, listen to part one before you listen to part two, but if you want to hear parts three and four, go subscribe to No Dogs in Space. We're going to be covering so many bands this season. We're going to be covering Suicide, The Damned, Joy Division, The Ramones, The Misfits, The Cramps, and many, many, many more. So please, subscribe to No Dogs in Space. Thank y'all very much for listening.
Drop your daily dose of acid this morning.
You know it, baby. Before every single performance, that's a little known fact that most people don't know about me, is that I take two tabs of acid before every single podcast.
Good. Acid being B12.
Welcome to No Dogs in Space, everybody. I'm Marcus Parks.
Oh, and I'm Carolina Hidalgo.
And we're continuing today with the story of the Stooges.
Yeah, the second part is always the meatier part of a sandwich.
It really is. Like, on the second part, we're going to be covering the first two Stooges albums, along with fucking everything else that happened around those albums.
Yeah, and a lot of it did.
So when we last left the band, the Stooges were still experimenting with the stage personas that would come to define them as one of the most confrontational and exciting live groups of the late 60s and early 70s. The thing about artists like the Stooges, who do something totally new, is that those groups don't appear just fully formed on stage from the outset. And usually, when you're doing something new, the road to genius is pretty goddamn rough. See, when the Stooges first started, while they did see that the hippie scene was essentially vapid and empty, Stooges saw that shit immediately. They still had the hippie-like optimism in their experimentation with the avant-garde, because the Stooges started off as an avant-garde band.
Oh, yeah. Don't forget the Osterizer.
How could I ever forget the Osterizer?
It belongs at a museum.
But the Stooges were starting to realize that blind hippie optimism wasn't getting them or anyone else anywhere. And after that bad acid trip we talked about in the last episode, Iggy Pop in particular was realizing that what people did respond to when it came to his performances was brutality, aggression, and a fair amount of nihilism.
He called his music a savage blowtorch of nihilism.
I mean, that's pretty accurate, I'd say.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's more than a fair amount of nihilism. But, like, nihilism in 1969, like, that shit wasn't selling. But they were doing it anyway.
You know, I heard in a BBC interview that Iggy Pop did in 1976. So this is, like, after the Stooges.
Oh, yeah. That's way after the Stooges.
And he said that Iggy seems to do what Jim needs to and can't bring himself to do.
Oh, that sounds fucking awful.
I don't know what that means exactly.
I got a feeling. Well, we're definitely going to explore that concept quite a bit in episode 3. Because at this point, he's still tinkering with it. He hasn't quite given himself over to Iggy Pop. Because Jim Osterberg and Iggy Pop are two extremely different people.
Oh, right. Because he used to wear loafers.
Yeah, exactly. And I do love, we'll also get into David Bowie's nickname for Iggy Pop, which is just Jimmy.
Jimmy. Come here, Jimmy. I like it.
And don't forget, this is still, like I said, 1968 in America. Besides all the good time vibes, you also had the fucking Vietnam War.
Conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you still had the draft. The draft was sending thousands of kids to their death every fucking month. It was still a very real threat to every young man in America if you weren't in college or if you weren't rich enough to get out of it. And the Stooges, they were in neither of those situations.
That's right. I mean, Iggy did go to college, but he only went for a semester.
Because he was a musician.
Well, yeah.
And he doesn't need to go to college.
He didn't want any rules. People tell him when the paper is due. So Iggy was actually caught in the midst of all this and being drafted because Jeep Holland, who was managing the Prime Movers, which Iggy was in at the time. G. Pollen said that he actually did manage to get a lot of musicians out of the draft. He counted about 20.
Wow.
Yeah. So the version that Jeep says is that Iggy stood in line with the other men when they were being tested for everything, and they were told to take off their clothes all the way down to their underwear, but Iggy got completely naked and grabbed onto his dick, and he was yelling like, "No one is touching my dick!
No one's touching my dick, man!
No one!" And they had these people in the army like who had to like try to pick him up. They literally picked him up on each side, and they could not pry his arms open because, you know, he's a drummer. He has arms of steel.
Oh, yeah, no, we're strong. They could have tried prying his hands off of his dick.
It didn't happen. And Jeep Holland said the whole thing lasted 30 minutes.
That's a long, like, 30 minutes doesn't seem like a long amount of time, but 30 minutes of someone trying to pry your hands off of your dick while you're screaming and squirming around, 30 minutes is a long fucking time.
So obviously they told him, like, just get out.
Yeah.
Iggy's version in his autobiography, I Need More, he said he got naked but still made sure to jerk off a little to get hard. And when someone noticed, he started yelling and shaking all over and over again. He just acting all cracked out. He's like, "I'm really scared, man. I'm really
real scared, man. I get hard when I get scared. I'm sorry."
And they asked him like, "Oh, well, why are you scared?" He's like, "'Cause I'm gay." And having men in their underwear around me is just making me really, really gay. He kept yelling like, "Help me." And that lasted an hour and a half.
You just got to keep going sometimes. Just got to keep going.
And so Ron Ashton, he also had to go up later, like a couple years later, since he was a little younger. But all he had to do was stay up for a couple days and show up drunk.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, even though all this is like, it's funny, it's kind of goofy. I mean, remember, these guys were having to do this shit to escape certain death.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure how long Private James Osterberg would have lasted in fucking Vietnam.
Oh, not very long. Either that or he would have been like that surfer dude in Apocalypse Now. And he would have just wandered around high and just gone home.
So in order to channel all of this negative shit, Jim Osterberg created the character of Iggy as we know him today. See, the wild man persona of Iggy in those days pretty much just lived on stage, because Jim still had to get the Stooges to rehearsal every day.
The rehearsals were only 20 minutes long. That's like an errand.
You've never been in a band.
No.
No, it's difficult. It's very difficult. But more and more, people were starting to see that Jim wasn't coming around so much, making Iggy the dominant personality, which was admittedly more fun, but also much more destructive. And really, what Iggy Pop did is pretty much what Bowie did with personas like the Thin White Duke and Ziggy Stardust a few years later. It's just that Iggy Pop did it first and only did it once. But we'll get into the relationship between David Bowie and Iggy Pop on part three.
Oh, and don't forget Chris Gaines. Thanks to Iggy Pop, we have Chris Gaines, the alter ego of Garth Brooks.
How could I ever forget Chris Gaines? Remember that Saturday Night Live where it was Garth Brooks hosting and Chris Gaines, musical guest?
I remember Garth Brooks in Empty Nest, and he seemed like a nice guy.
You know what? He really is a nice guy.
I've heard good things.
So while Jim Osterberg was fine-tuning Iggy Pop, a young man from Elektra Records came to Detroit to see the MC5. That man's name was Danny Fields.
Ooh.
Of course, Danny Fields was immortalized forever in the fantastic Ramones track, Danny Says.
Danny says we gotta go, gotta go to Idaho.
Baby, oh, we got nowhere to go, and it may sound
love that song.
Yeah, Danny Says.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get into the relationship between Danny Fields and the Ramones when we do our series on the Ramones.
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Danny Fields, he's a really smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was deep into the arts and music scene. He wrote for magazines, and he DJed a radio show for WFMU.
Oh, I love WFMU. I still listen to WFMU in the shower almost every day.
You do?
Yeah, I absolutely love WFMU. Danny Fields, his career as a magazine writer, he was actually the guy that broke the Beatles' Bigger Than Jesus story.
Yeah. You know, he was friends with Linda McCartney, mm-hmm. and like really good friends. And then they're all hanging out together, and Linda goes, "You know, it was Danny who did that." And Paul's like, "Really? Really? You're eating my food."
Yeah, and it wasn't even like, I think it was in like 17 magazine or something like that. Because Danny Fields started his career in magazines for like teenage girls.
Right.
It was like,
yeah. It's a date.
Yes. Like first date or something weird like that. But yeah, mm-hmm. that's how he started his career, was in the teen magazine. So all you guys out there working in careers, you're like, this isn't quite right for me. Just keep building.
Keep going.
Keep going.
Because he eventually worked with Jim Morrison, the Velvet Underground, the Modern Lovers, and later discovered the Ramones, like you said, and managed them. But the thing about Danny Fields is that he is the most likable guy ever.
He's so likable. I just want to, like, I keep looking around at, like, every old Jewish man on the train and thinking, like, is that Danny Fields?
I hope it is.
I wonder, could I talk to him? Like, could I see? Because he lives here in the city still.
Yeah, we might have. Yeah, he's a New York City guy. And he came to Detroit to check out and eventually signed the MC5 while working for Elektra Records. Remember, he was hired as a publicist by Jack Holtzman, the director of Elektra Records.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Danny was labeled as like the company freak, the guy who finds what's cool out there, what the kids are listening to.
And that was his actual job title, was company freak.
Publicist, company freak, head of promotions, yeah, but company freak.
That's the funny thing is that company freak just meant it's like, yeah, I'll smoke a joint at my table. I don't care. That's how cool I am. I'll totally smoke a joint at my desk and try to tell me no.
So cool, man. And the reason why he was hired for this is because Elektra Records, until 1966, were just mainly only folk music.
Folk music and classical music.
Yes, and that's when they made a ton of money with the classical music. They started another label under Elektra called Nonesuch Records,
mm-hmm.
and that it made a European classical music. So they had all this extra money because it sold so well. Jack Holtzman's like, you know what? Let's get into something psychedelic.
Actually, I would like to play a little bit of what Elektra Records was putting out before the Doors, before the Stooges, before all of that cool shit. Some of the folk records that they put out were absolutely insane. One of the guys that Elektra had on their label for 2 decades is a guy named Oscar Brand. His albums include Body Songs and Backroom Ballads, Volumes 1, 2, and 3, Bring a Song, Johnny, which was just all children's recordings, Rollicking Sea Shanties, Body Hootenanny, The Wild Blue Yonder, Give 'em the Hook, or Songs That Killed Vaudeville, Boating Songs and All That Build, Sports Cars and Songs, Every Inch a Sailor, Out of the Blue, and Tell It to the Marines.
I wanted wings till I got the goddamn wings. Now I don't want them anymore. They
Oboe.
Taught me how to fly, then they sent me off to die. Well, I've had a belly full of war. You can save those bloody zeros for the other goddamn heroes. Distinguished flying crosses do not compensate for losses, a buster. I want the wings till I got the goddamn wings. Now I don't want them anymore. Yes,
that's pretty good. That's some pretty good anti-war music.
I don't know. Let's do psychedelic instead.
Yeah, All Along the Watchtower, I would say, is better. I would listen to that again rather than I Wanted Wings. But that's, you know, but that's the type of shit that that Elektra Records was putting out for 20 years.
And it worked.
Yeah.
It worked very well for them.
Yeah.
And then when they decided to go psychedelic, that was going to work too, right?
Immediately.
So Danny Fields gets hired by Elektra. He knows everyone, including John Sinclair, who mm-hmm. we talked about before. John Sinclair goes down to the radio station, WFMU, and says, hey, you got to check out this band in Michigan. Danny's like, all right, I'm going to Detroit. I'm going to check out this band, the MC5.
So when Danny went to Detroit in September of 1968, he'd never heard of the Psychedelic Stooges. Because remember, that's what the Stooges' original name was.
Yeah.
Danny's only interest during that trip was in the MC5. But the thing about the MC5 is that they'd started looking at the Stooges like a bit of a little brother band. So when Danny came to town, one of the dudes from the MC5 told him that he couldn't leave town without seeing the Psychedelic Stooges.
The next day, Danny went to see them perform at a benefit concert for the Children's Community School at the Union Ballroom on the U Michigan campus. Mm-hmm. And he was blown away. And this is a quote from him from what he saw from that show. It was like Beethoven finally got here. It was so solid and so modern and so non-blues. How long did it take me to recognize this was something special? 5 seconds.
Yeah. That's the amazing thing about it is that, you know, Iggy Pop was saying, like, this is my version of the blues. And Danny Field's first impression was, there's no fucking blues here.
No, but I get it. And then he goes backstage to meet Iggy and the rest of the band. And he just, like, opens the door. He's like, you're a star. And all look up like, what?
Iggy, you're a star, boy. I'm going to get you on the first plane to New York City. You're going to be on Broadway for the end of the week.
And Ron's like, who's this asshole? And Iggy's like, look, man, I'm straight. I know there have been rumors.
Yeah, and Danny Fields like told him, like, hi, I work for Elektra Records. And Iggy Pop thought he was like a janitor or something. Because they were just starting out. Like, you know, it was, you know, very rare for a band to get attention that early on.
They'd been playing just like it was less than a year.
Yeah. So after seeing the show and talking to Iggy, Danny called up Jack Holtzman and said, Elektra Records should sign not only the MC5, but the Psychedelic Stooges as well.
Right. And Jack Holtzman's like, great, oh, cool, but we got to go see them. Mm-hmm. So Jack and Bill Harvey, the president of Elektra, saw them perform October 8th at the Fifth Dimension. And then that's when it finally happened. They finally got signed.
They were opening for the Fifth Dimension?
No, it was the venue called Fifth Dimension. No, they were not opening for the Fifth Dimension.
I was about to say that. My brain was starting to get real confused real fast. So the MC5 got offered a $20,000 advance, while the Psychedelic Stooges got an offer of $5,000. Now, of course, both bands said, fuck yes, sign us right now. There was only one condition with the Psychedelic Stooges. For God's sake, drop the psychedelic. Just be the Stooges.
For $5,000? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, Elektra actually had to call Mo Howard from the Three Stooges. And it must have been a weird afternoon for Mo Howard. He just picks up the phone and then they're like, hey, we got this band. Is it okay that they're called the Stooges? And Mo Howard's like, who is this? And then they explain to him, he's like, no, it's not a comedy troupe. It's not a comedy band. They're just a band. And he's just like, yeah, sure.
As long as they're not the Three Stooges.
That's right.
Who gives a shit? Well, that's the funny thing is that the Stooges, I think it was it Ron Ashton, like, actually made friends with Larry Fine?
Yeah, the other Stooge.
Yeah, not Curly, made friends with Larry. And, like, they would hang out sometimes.
Oh, yeah, no, they spent time, like, a lot of time talking together, and Larry would always be like, you got any smokes on you? He liked having him around.
To bring some of those cigars in here, there's a nurse in here that's trying to keep me alive. But the problem the Stooges had was that even though they'd been playing together by this point for almost a year, their showtime was still clocking in at only about 20 minutes.
It takes a while to, you know, get enough material.
It really does. I mean, to have a full album within a year, like, it's rare. I mean, it happens. I mean, I think the Strokes had a full album within, like, 9 months or something like that. Like, it was real fucking fast, but they were practicing a lot more.
A little longer
than, like, you know, 20 minutes, like, just getting high together and fucking around with a blender and then, like, okay, that's good, guys. See you later. Well, in other words, even though the Stooges had just signed a record deal, they didn't have enough songs to fill even side A of an album. So the Stooges started having high-volume practices every night to develop a recordable, sellable sound, even though rehearsals were still only 20 minutes.
That's all it is. It's a sitcom.
But also, like, being in a band, like, sometimes you will have a rehearsal where you're in the same room together for 3 hours, but you actually play for only about 20 or 30 minutes.
What else are you doing?
Hanging out.
Oh,
you're
okay.
Hanging out with your buddies, having a couple beers, talking about this and that and whatnot.
And then you go home and it's like, I forgot, what were we doing?
Meanwhile, Danny Fields was trying to find the right producer to transfer what he saw in Detroit onto an album, and he thought he'd found it in the Velvet Underground's John Cale, heard here playing the viola.
Sacrificials remain, make it hard to forget where you come from. The stools of your eyes serve to realize fame. Choose again. Roben is refrain of the sacrilege recluse for the loss of a horse with the bows and the tail of a rat. Come again, choose to go.
Now, as anyone who sat down and listened to the Velvet Underground's first album knows, John Cale was a man who knew how to meld the avant-garde with straight rock and roll, especially when you consider that the clip we just played is on the same album as Run, Run, Run.
Teenage Bear, said Uncle Dave, I sold my soul. Must be saved. Gonna take a walk down Union Square. You never know where you're gonna find there. You gotta run, 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 run. Take the dragon too. Run, 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 run. Jim's the death of you. Hey, what you do? Margarita Passion, they had to get her fixed. She wasn't well, she was getting sick. Went to sell her soul, she wasn't high. Didn't know, think she could buy it. She would run, 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 run. Take the dragon too. Run, 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 run. Chip to death in you. Tell you what to do.
Another thing you got to remember is that while we know of the Velvet Underground's first album as a half-century-old relic of New York hipness, when the Stooges were signed, that album had only come out the year before.
Really?
Yeah, maybe 2 years before.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, but less than five. Like,
yeah.
Like it was.
Oh, yeah.
It was a super recent, super cool, super hip album. And it's fun. It's really fun to think about that. Like, because, you know, I'm sure we both heard Velvet Underground and Nico for the first time, probably in college, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and by that time it was 40 years old. But it's fun to think, like, in that time, like, John Cale was, like, a hip, cool, new young dude that was, like, doing cool shit, where now he's, you know, all these people are godfathers now, but back then all these guys were just kind of in the mix together.
That's one thing I've noticed by looking up all these people. I'm like, oh, what, they were, like, 50 or something? Oh, they've been in the record industry for 20 years. What do you mean you're 29? It's weird.
It's very strange, yeah. But before Cale went into the studio with the Stooges, he wanted to get to know the band a little bit first. So he traveled from New York City to Ann Arbor, Michigan for a nice little visit to the Fun House.
John Cale had fun at the Fun House. He did. Oh, well, except the only problem he really had with them was, like, there was no food ever. He opened a fridge and be like, there's only Bud Lights in there or something. And he's like, hey, where's the food? And then, like, how do you eat? And Iggy's like, whatever, man.
Think I got some beans.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that was another way for Iggy to get people motivated, is that he would send out for food or get everyone high. and then that's the only way to get it to work. And so John Cale got to see all that. John Cale was also weird in his own right.
Yeah.
I mean, he would just walk around like half naked.
That's the funny thing, isn't it?
Like black bikini briefs.
It is funny because like we're talking about John Cale, like John Cale's the adult in this situation. He's the same fucking age as these guys, like maybe a little bit older, but not much older.
Really not much. And he would still like, he would be drinking red wine and hanging out, drugs, maybe take them sometimes, mm-hmm. chasing after girls. Like he was just, yeah, he was just another guy.
Yeah. After seeing the Stooges live, Cale totally got what they were going for, and he was impressed enough to bring the band to New York City to hang out at Maxis, Kansas City, and Andy Warhol's Factory, which those were two clubs that were the absolute height of New York cool. And it was at the Factory that Iggy met an eternally bored German model cum singer named Nico.
And what costume shall the poor girl wear to all tomorrow's parties? A hand-me-down dress from who knows where. Where will she go? What shall she do when midnight comes around? She turned once more to Sunday's cloud and cried behind the door.
Oh, Nico, the female Zoolander. The thing about Nico, I mean, she was an actress, she was a singer, she was a songwriter, she did a lot in her lifetime.
Yeah.
And I mean,
Nico was like a true artist.
Fellini discovered her. She knew how to hang around the coolest people ever.
Yeah.
You know, Andy Warhol, and just kind of because she was so striking, but also she had this like crazy exotic German thing going on, which was very hot.
Yeah.
And she also sang famously with the Velvet Underground.
Of course. And had two fantastic albums in her own right, Marble Index and Chelsea Girl. Both fucking great albums. I mean, like, Marble Index, like...
Marble Index.
You only need to listen to Marble Index, like, once.
It's very depressing.
It's very depressing.
I'm glad that it's there.
Of course.
But I don't need to hear it again.
It's like a super depressing movie, like, where you just kind of only need to watch Irreversible once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Like, it's not your favorite movie.
And if you want to watch it zero times, I totally respect that.
Well, no, I mean, but Nico was, she was a true fucking artist, and she had a beautiful voice. I mean, I know her voice can be a bit of an acquired taste, but I fucking love Nico.
Now that it's time, now that the hour hand is landed at the end, now that it's real, now that the dreams have given all they had to lend, I want to know, do I stay or do I go, and maybe try another time? And do I really have a hand in my forgetting?
I'm a big Nico fan.
Iggy was a big Nico fan for a long time, too. He actually said, he quote, "I was one of the very few who actually liked her music." When the Stooges did come, like, they ended up coming to the Warhol Factory, and they just hung around with all these people, and Iggy just immediately, with the New York scene, he just, I mean, they were already known because they just got signed and everything. He just took to it very well.
Yeah.
Ron and Scott and Dave, these are Midwestern boys.
Yeah.
Not so much like Iggy is. They kind of just sat on the couch and, like, with their sunglasses on, like, sipping their drinks and just being like, man, this is... we're leaving.
Yeah, what the fuck are we doing here?
They didn't last very long there. They just couldn't mingle in. I mean, even when they met Andy Warhol again later in L.A., like, they just avoided him.
Yeah.
And Iggy just went in for it. He didn't care. He was fearless.
I mean, honestly, I would have been one of the Ashtons. Like, if I would have been in this situation, like, going to Andy Warhol's factory, like, yeah, I would have just sat on the couch and said, like, I don't know what to say to these people.
What do we do? We just stand there. We're posing. And there's all these bright lights on me.
Yeah, it's like, what am I going to go talk to fucking Twiggy? I don't know.
But so Nico and Iggy met each other. And immediately, Nico just being so enamored with this guy who's this amazing, like, performer. And Iggy's like, this woman is striking and beautiful and so experienced and much older, like 10 years older than him at the time. He was 21. They just kind of got on together, like, almost immediately. And they're just walking around holding hands and everything and just kind of making out. They were in the club scene together. And everyone just kept doing, like, double takes or spitting out their drink. She's with him? Jessica Rabbit is with Roger Rabbit of the music scene?
Well, they said, I think it Please Kill Me, that Nico's taste in men was what tragic poets, tragic self-destructive poets, because before Iggy Pop, Nico dated Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
So she had a type. And when the Stooges went back to Ann Arbor to the Funhouse, Nico went with them.
Yeah, she did. She stayed there. Some people said a few weeks. I really think it was a few months.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed there. But you know what? The other guys didn't mind her this time. Like, they really didn't. Like, she would make a lot of brown rice and vegetables. At least they got to eat.
Yeah.
And then she'd leave around, like, bottles of red wine for, like, good wine for them to drink. And they're just like, she's all right. And she stayed with Iggy. She taught him how to eat pussy.
And good for her.
Good for her. And good for him.
And good for him. Yeah, and they made a little movie together, too. Like, I can't remember what it was called, but they went out into the field and painted Iggy's face white and made a nice little short film.
Yeah, that was the Evening of Light song that she was doing, like, a little promotional, you know, this is before MTV video that she did. She found, like, this French guy, Francois de Menil. And he was really interested in making some sort of film with her. And she's like, you got to come to Ann Arbor because I'm here with Iggy and the guys. And they're going to be in the movie, too. And he's like, all right. You could find it on YouTube. It's just them, like, kind of walking around outside the fun house. She's, like, all in white. And there's, like, mannequins everywhere. It's just very, it looks like a horror movie / European artsy film.
Yeah. And it's fun, but I can only imagine, like, fucking Nico, like, this, like, German art star, suddenly finding herself in fucking Ann Arbor, Michigan. Like, suddenly roommates with Iggy Pop. Like, it seems like such a fucking fantastic, like, it seems like such an out-of-this-world experience.
Yeah, well, she had a good time, and they had a great time together, but there were times also when Iggy had to do his own thing. Like, she would call up Danny Fields and be like, Iggy's so mean to me.
Danny, Iggy's being mean again.
Oh, no. And Danny's just like, what did you expect?
Everyone knew he was an asshole. Come on. So after Nico left Ann Arbor, it was time for the Stooges to actually get to work on the album itself. And since they didn't really have the songs, but they were still fantastically talented musicians, Cale told them to just forget about the stage show and just concentrate on the album itself. And so Ron sat down and right out of the gate wrote the foundations for the two best songs on the album. One, 1969, you heard at the beginning of the first episode, but the other was a song that was so simple yet impactful that it became the de facto tryout song for punk bands for decades to come. Because it was the one song that fucking everybody knew. That song was I Wanna Be Your Dog.
So messed up, I want you. Face to face.
I love that song. Hey, you remember when I got you that vinyl for Christmas like 3 years ago?
You got me a first pressing of the Stooges' first record. Yes, it was one of the best gifts I've ever gotten in my entire life.
Oh, thank you. That song reminds me of that.
Of course. Man, nobody can do Come On like Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
Come on! And, like, it's just, it's the best Come On in rock and roll. But as the Stooges were writing these fantastic songs, their seemingly endless stream of bad luck when it came to the actual business of being in a band began when Danny Fields got fired from Elektra.
Yeah, well, you know, Danny, as wonderful as he is.
He is a wonderful man. Go watch the documentary Danny Says. It's on Netflix. Tells you everything you need to know about Danny Fields. It's fucking great.
But he did get fired.
Yes.
Because he pissed off the vice president of Elektra, Bill Harvey. His daughter was getting married, and he made a joke around the office saying, like, that sounds like a shotgun wedding, if you ask me.
It's so fucking dumb.
And Bill Harvey punched him in the face. Punched him.
It's the dumbest shit. Like, all of these things, like, it's not, no one is fucking up on principle. No one's fucking, like, everyone's just making dumbass decisions left and right. Because after Danny Fields got fired, the MC5 decided they needed to start fucking up for no reason as well.
Oh, fuck Hudson's.
Yeah, oh, fuck Hudson's.
Okay, so Hudson's used to be a record chain store in the Detroit area, and they refused to sell MC5 records with the word motherfucker in the liner notes of the album.
Just in the liner notes. Like, not even in the lyrics. Like, it was just in the liner notes, which is a dumb decision. Like, I think, like, Hudson's was definitely wrong here. However,
John Sinclair and or the MC5 took out a full page ad in the Ann Arbor Argus newspaper and Detroit's Fifth Estate that said, kick out the gyms, motherfuckers, and kick in the door. The store won't sell you the album on Elektra. Fuck Hudson's! With the Elektra logo on it. Like, oh, it looked like Elektra was behind this.
I know. And they just did all this shit themselves. It's like, I understand that it sounds like a good idea at the time, and I understand putting up your fucking middle finger. You know, and but you also gotta understand as well, it's like, these are dudes in their 20s. Like, these are all dudes in their early 20s. They're not thinking shit through. But the thing is about it is that the MC5 were on a trajectory at this point. Like, yeah. The MC5 should have been one of the biggest bands of the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, they were great.
The MC5, everyone should know who the MC5 are. But the MC5 just never quite made it over the top, because this little fucking stunt right here completely ruined any momentum that the MC5 had, because they got dropped from Elektra. Because right as soon as Elektra heard about it, because Hudson's actually did have a pretty sizable chunk of the Midwest market, and Elektra still had all those classical music records to sell. Like, Elektra was still, and the only way that they could get their records back into Hudson's was to drop the MC5. So the MC5 got dropped from Elektra, and they never recovered. But the one good thing that came out of all this mess was that even though the Stooges were now tainted by their association to Danny Fields and the MC5.
Oh, don't worry. They're going to taint their own reputations very soon.
Plenty of tainting to come. Their manager, Jimmy Silver, was able to negotiate a bigger advance, and the Stooges ended up with $25,000 in their pocket, which in today's money is almost $200,000.
That's a lot of drug money.
It's a ton of drugs. It's way too much money to give to a bunch of 21-year-old kids that really like drugs.
So maybe the MC5 being dropped was good for the Stooges. They got to focus primarily on the Stooges now.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it did. There are some unintended consequences. You know, the MC5 gets taken down a peg, but the Stooges go up a peg. And it really is one of those kind of weird what-if moments in rock and roll history. I mean, even though, like, the MC5 did end up being huge influences on all kinds of people in the punk scene later on, like, you kind of wonder how the fabric of, like, the American rock music scene would have changed had the MC5 reached the levels of, say, like, not even necessarily, like, a Led Zeppelin, but maybe, like, the Doors. Like, yeah. If the MC5 had gotten to that level, like, if the MC5 would have got just one number one hit, I mean, I think rock music would have changed.
Yeah, because I think they made one more album and then that was the end of it.
Yeah, that was yeah, that was it. And there was like a few live albums afterwards. You know, Fred Sonic Smith went out and married Patti Smith. The other guys just kind of went off and did whatever.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Yes, we'll talk about that later. It is like the MC5, if only they hadn't put out that fucking ad. The whole... The whole fucking fabric of American rock music could have changed.
I don't know about that, actually. There were a couple other things that also happened that added to it.
That was the gunshot to the head.
And then, well, also Iggy did say in the Total Chaos book, he's like, yeah, too bad about the MC5. Also, there was like some photos circulating around with them and some kind of naked woman. Yeah, so, you know, something that just didn't look good.
Didn't look right.
Like, and, you know, and she's smelling the glove.
Well, as we said on the first episode, the MC5 has since apologized.
Yes.
For all of their misogynist behavior. So, the Stooges showed up at the Hit Factory in Times Square and got to the recording of their debut album. Now, one of the most famous stories about the recording has to do with volume. From what the Stooges said, they didn't think they sounded like the Stooges unless all the amps were turned up to 10. And John Cale kept trying to convince them this was going to sound really fucking bad. That you're not supposed to do that. It's going to blow everything out and everything's just going to sound like mud.
Why is there a 10 then? You follow my logic?
The story goes that the Stooges staged a strike in the studio and refused to play until a compromise was reached to turn the volume to 9. But John Cale said he doesn't remember any of this.
You're wasting studio time.
They had 5 days to record this album.
Plus, they actually added another 3 when they realized they weren't done yet.
Yeah, John Cale later said, if there was a sit-down strike, it wasn't because they were angry with anything I said. More likely, they just wanted to have a beer.
Most likely.
But either way, this seminal album was recorded damn near live with no multi-tracking. And no song took more than 2 or 3 takes. Because, like I said, they only had 5 days to finish it. In fact, some album tracks, like this one, are the first take.
Can I come over tonight? Can I come over tonight? What do you think I wanna do? That's right. Can I come over tonight? I said we will have a real cool time tonight. I said we will have a real cool time tonight.
Now, as fucking great as that song is, to be fair, the lyrics to that song, real cool time, are mostly, we will have a real cool time tonight.
Can I come over?
And part of the reason why that song and a few of the others sound so raw is because the Stooges wrote a lot of them the night before, for better or worse.
Oh, paper's due by noon, man. We gotta get cracking. Which they did at the Chelsea Hotel.
Mm-hmm, where eventually Nancy Spungen ended up dying.
Oh, that's right. Dying, yeah. Murdered, killed. So they show up to New York, and they're like, we're ready to record an album.
We're good, man.
Yes. And then they're asked, oh, cool, but you got any more songs? And they're like, you betcha. And then they
bet your bottom dollar.
They ran up to the hotel and was like, fuck, okay, all right, Ron, you get on that guitar now and come up with some riffs. I'll be back in an hour of lyrics. Scott, get me a pen. This is a hotel room. They always have pens. And then they just rehearsed it a few times, and bam, they had an album.
Oh, man. And these songs, like, you can hear some of the subtle influences we talked about in the last episode, even in the frat rock songs, because What's the old line? I think it was like Steinbeck said, like, good artists create, great artists steal.
Right.
There was a lot of theft in this album, which the Stooges totally admit to. But just for an example of like one of the things that kind of, I think they did not admit to stealing this. This is just one of my own little things.
This is only Marcus's thing.
I know this is only me, but I know there's probably like one other person out there that's going to listen to this and go like, yeah, I kind of hear it. Let's listen to a comparison of the 1965 Strange Love's hit, I Want Candy, to 1969 by the Stooges.
Good luck.
It's the drums.
I don't hear it. I can't.
It's all in. We almost got into a fight one day because I kept bringing Carolina into the office and being like, I think I got it this time. Listen again.
I heard it like 7 times in a row because I like to believe that you're right initially.
And I definitely appreciate your willingness to indulge me on this. Then I kept getting mad.
You should really put a couch in your office because standing there awkwardly is weird.
Well, of course, since the Stooges were recording this album in New York, Nico came by, and she'd visit here and there. She'd just sit in the control booth next to John Cale. She'd just knit. And then John Cale, for some reason, he decided to wear a Dracula cape through the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, he'd just seen Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I believe.
Okay.
Z-Man.
And the Stooges did manage to get one track that was probably the closest to what they sounded like back in their drone days. That song, clocking in at 10 minutes, 18 seconds, is the Velvet Underground influenced track, We Will Fall.
Then I whisper to me, then I'll lay right down. Then I'll lay right down. On my back.
You know, that was Dave's doing. Yeah, because Jimmy Silver lent him a book by Swami Ramdas.
Swami Ramdas, huh?
Holy man.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a guru, and which sounded a lot of like one of his chants, like the Ram, Ja, Ja, Ram.
Yeah. Ram, Ja, Ram, Ja.
Because Dave Alexander was always into reading mysticism and the occult.
Yeah.
So that was another Chelsea Hotel job to do. Like, Dave, you take care of the chant thing. And he did.
He did.
Song's great.
That's, I fucking love that song. And that's the funny thing about the Stooges. The Stooges were really into the occult, at least around that time. But on the other hand, in 1968, 1969, fucking everybody was into the occult. Like, it was just one. It
some
was like
ranch in California. I think they got into some weird shit, too.
I mean, it was a fad. You know, that's the weird thing about the occult. It's like 68, 69. Yeah, it was just this strange, weird little fad that kind of popped up and then, I don't know, disappeared again.
Well, it came back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it came back again now.
Yeah, well we're trying our best. But the funny thing is that some of the Stooges didn't even like the album.
They hated it.
They fucking absolutely hated it because to them, it didn't sound like the Stooges. You know, Scott Ashton, lamenting the loss of his beloved oil drums, later described every track outside of We Will Fall as, quote, drippy, dweepy little songs.
Aw, that's a good alliteration, though.
It's very good. Alliteration, but yeah. And what was more, the Stooges fucking hated John Cale's production on the album, and that wouldn't be the last time the Stooges believed one of their records was ruined post-recording. From what the Stooges say, they were just following orders, and some of them openly wondered afterwards if recording the album was even the right thing to do for the band, even after the Stooges were revered as legends.
Well, you gotta listen to the John Cale mix. It's on YouTube.
It's cool.
Yeah. No, I think it's pretty good, but it's very different from what they eventually came out with.
Yeah.
You know, Iggy Pop had to sit with Jack Holtzman to figure out how to make the band happy. Jack Holtzman said he got someone else to mix it. Iggy at one point said that he mixed it himself. Conflicting reports on it, but both versions are on YouTube, and I really like the John Cale mix.
I like the John Cale mix a lot, too.
But if it's not the way the Stooges wanted it to be, then so be it, then.
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately, it is up to the band what they want the whole thing to sound like. And honestly, I'm kind of inclined to agree with Scott Ashton when it comes to side two of the record. Because while the first four, maybe five songs are certifiable classics,
yeah,
the last three sound like demos. I mean, they're ideas of songs rather than actual tracks you'd put on an album. The one exception is possibly Little Doll, but that's only because Little Doll is pretty much just 1969 revisited.
Little doll I can't forget, smoking on a cigarette. In my life a real queen, prettiest thing I ever seen.
You know, Iggy said he came up with Little Doll in the lobby at the Chelsea Hotel. And as we know, they were big fans of Pharoah Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he took from the bass line of Upper and Lower Egypt.
Yeah, and I definitely checked out Upper and Lower Egypt after hearing that. And yeah.
Do you hear it now?
Do you hear it now?
I want candy.
Of course, recording the album was the right thing for the Stooges to do, because after they came out of the studio, they had actual songs in addition to Confidence, which they didn't really have going in. And so the Stooges returned to Ann Arbor in 1969 feeling damn near invincible, and Iggy started taking the stage shows even further.
Iggy was starting to make himself bleed on stage.
Yeah.
Like, he started to open up his skin. In one show in Ohio, he used a broken drumstick and just raked it against his chest.
Yeah.
And it just, like, the blood just went through his white shirt, made people nauseous.
Yeah, I mean, he's just taking it further and further and further. And man, you can see the scars on him now.
Well, he wanted to get a strong reaction, because that show I told you about in Ohio, they played at a venue that could hold like hundreds, thousands of people maybe, and only like 12 to 15 showed up, and they're all just kind of there bored. So he needed to go to the next level.
Yeah, and that was, you know, when back when I was in bands, like, that was always the philosophy. It's like, you play the same show for 5 people as you do for 50, as you do for 500. It's like, no matter who's there, they came to see a fucking show, so put on a good show every fucking time. And Iggy was taking it further than just blood. At one festival in Pottawatomie Beach, Iggy, already bleeding after busting his lip with a microphone, started throwing up on stage as Muddy Waters watched from the wings in disgust.
Did he know?
Yeah, he knew Muddy Waters was over there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And in a scene that sounds like straight out of, like, it's fucking straight out of Mad Magazine, Muddy Waters told his friend that, oh man, those boys need to get themselves an act. And his friend replied, Muddy, that is the act. But it was during this time of increased excess that Iggy Pop met Wendy Weisberg, who was mercifully 19 years old. Now, it was said that Iggy was obsessed with Wendy, but I think it would be more accurate to say that Iggy was obsessed with fucking Wendy, because Wendy was a virgin.
That's true. He did meet her even before all this, before he got the record deal. He met her when he was 19, and they were both in college, mm-hmm. but back then she was a White Panther's girlfriend, so, you know.
One of the White Panthers, not just a guy named White Panther.
It is a guy named White Panther.
Okay, so it's actually a dude named White Panther. All right.
We keep having this.
The late 60s were a very confusing time.
Yes, but he was too afraid to talk to her because, you know, she was so beautiful. But later, he got that confidence after recording the album. So when he was doing that show in Ohio, you know, the one where he bled from the broken drumstick, mm-hmm. she came from backstage after the show and was like, what did you just do? And then he was like, hey, what are you doing later? And she's like, I'm with my boyfriend right now. And he said, well, can I call you? Eventually, he did worm his way into her heart.
Yeah. But Wendy was adamant that she would not have sex before marriage. So, to get through that little roadblock, Iggy fucking married her.
He bought the cow. She was very beautiful. She's not a cow.
No.
But yeah, because they got together in May of 1969, and they were married by July 12th of 1969. It was just a few months. And they got married right outside of the funhouse. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Silver officiated the wedding as an ordained clergyman at the Universal Life Church.
Which Henry Zebrowski is an ordained minister at the Universal Life Church now because he married us.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, Henry.
So the MC5 came, Iggy's parents came, Danny Fields flew in for the wedding, because the night before he got a phone call, and he's like, you're doing what? And he had to, like, rush over there to come to the wedding. And then Ron Ashton served as best man and was nice enough to leave his SS uniform in his closet, but he wore his Luftwaffe uniform because he said they were soldiers. It's not political. It's different.
Iggy is marrying Wendy Weisberg.
And Jimmy Silver is officiating. They were Jewish. And it was very nice of Ron. Such
Ron,
a nice guy.
He's not a Nazi.
As we talked about in the first episode, Ron is not a Nazi. He just has a weird fascination with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what they serve for dinner?
What?
Buckwheat casserole.
Ugh.
Because they were big into macrobiotics.
Jimmy Silver was big into macrobiotics.
That's right. And the MC5 were so pissed. They didn't even have dinner, so they got trashed. Everyone had a great time at the wedding, especially when Iggy's friends and his best man were making bets on how long the marriage was going to last.
Yeah, Danny Fields said that, I think he was quoted as saying, these fucking shoes are going to last longer than this marriage.
Ron said a month, and he was the closest to everyone else. He won the pot.
Technically, he shouldn't have won because he went over for going by Price is Right rules. Technically, nobody should have won.
No one wins. And so Wendy moves in that day. She and her friends are moving up all her stuff up to the attic where Iggy was living so they could live together as man and wife.
Mm-hmm.
Iggy just sees all these boxes going up, and he's just thinking, how am I going to get out of this? And the guys in the band, they didn't like Wendy. They called her Potato Girl. Potato Girl.
I know exactly what they
what
mean.
What does that mean?
I can't explain it, but I know exactly what they mean.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, some things are better laid to rest.
Some things we don't need to get into.
Yeah. But, and Iggy had some complaints about Wendy as well. Like, for example, she liked to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want him smoking pot and hanging around with his loser friends. So Iggy, like, at night, he liked to stay up because he slept all day. So at night, he had to lock himself in his closet with his guitar and his amp, trying to be quiet, and came up with Down on the Beach.
Which eventually became
Down on the Street.
Exactly.
Because the rest of the band was like, we don't go to the beach. Why the beach? Plus, the song wasn't about Wendy anymore.
Yeah.
So they had to change it around.
Of course.
So Iggy's already coming up with a second album while she was there.
Yeah.
And then he realized, I can't do both. It's either her or the career. So he just asked her to leave. You know, he's like, this could only be temporary, maybe. Yeah. And she was sad about it. She understood, though. And they got an annulment because her parents were adamant about getting an annulment.
It was, oh, thank God.
Yeah. I mean, she came from a wealthy family.
Yeah.
And according to Ron, but there's no actual proof of this, they hung up the annulment papers on the wall for ages. And on it, it said the reason for the annulment was Iggy's homosexuality. That the marriage was never consummated.
Well, he used that one a lot, didn't he?
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you. You read Iggy Pop's autobiography, his 1986 autobiography. How many pages did he devote to this story?
Four. Four pages. And it's not a big book.
It's. I mean, it is a healthy percentage of the book.
Of his 3-week relationship.
So about a month after the annulment, the Stooges' self-titled debut was released. Now, to give you an idea of what the mood of the record-buying public was like at that time, Woodstock happened the same week. So while most people were looking to feel good about all the useless hippie bullshit that they all ended up betraying anyway by turning the planet into a flaming fucking shitbag,
all right.
The Stooges were selling reality, which is a state of mind that a lot of baby boomers still have a hard time grasping.
Breathe.
No fun for my baby. No fun. No fun for my baby. No fun. No fun to hang around. Feeling that same old way. No fun to hang around. Freak out for another day. No fun. No fun. No fun. For my baby. No fun. No fun to be alone. Walking by myself. No fun to be alone. But in love. With nobody.
Well, the thing is about No Fun is that it's not about moping or wallowing. Rather, it's exactly what Iggy Pop set out to do in the first place. This was his version of the blues, what was going on in his life. And unlike a lot of people at the time, Iggy Pop and the rest of the Stooges weren't going to ignore that shit. Because people weren't ready for the Stooges, the first album sold terribly, moved only about 32,000 copies, in the same summer that the soundtrack for the fucking Let's All Congratulate Ourselves for Being Hippies musical, the fucking Hair sold 3 million.
What?
That same summer. It's not like, I mean, like the hippies, I mean, it was fucking mainstream.
Yeah.
Like it was totally mainstream. Fucking Hair, 3 million, Stooges self-titled debut, 32,000.
Still going strong.
As Iggy put it, the Stooges were the counter to the counterculture, which even wasn't even that much of a fucking counterculture to begin with. It was still fucking mainstream.
Well, he said, like, I heard all this music around me, and I thought, like, I gotta attack.
Yeah.
Because that's what he did. He attacked. Like, he put it in your face.
Yeah.
I mean, not a lot of faces, unfortunately. 32,000 only, but, you know, still did.
Yeah, and it would take years before anyone would give the Stooges their due. But even though the Stooges weren't moving units, they found that they were suddenly the cool kids. Like, they went to New York City. Like, they're like, yeah, man, like, this is fucking cool. Like, everyone's loving the album. Everyone's all of the right people are getting the album and are loving it and are giving all these guys all sorts of positive reinforcement. But that's not to say the Stooges were perfect. Even though they did make music that truly changed the world, the Stooges, and especially Iggy Pop, still did some real fucked up shit.
Yeah.
See, it was around this time that Iggy Pop, at the age of 23, started dating a girl named Betsy. Betsy was about 14.
Oy.
Now, the subject of teenage girls, when it comes to rock and roll musicians, you know, from, I would say, the beginning of the genre up until about...
Mankind.
Up until about, like, the 90s is kind of when rock and roll musicians started saying, like, we probably shouldn't be doing that no more. That's
it came from everywhere.
It really did.
Like Elvis Presley, Jimmy Page.
Jerry Lee Lewis married his 13-year-old cousin.
Marvin Gaye met his second wife when she was 17.
Yes. It's hard to say, like, all of them. Like, it's like, oh, you know, like, everybody did it, so it's cool. That's not a fucking excuse. This is a very thorny knot to untangle.
And this is a hard thing even to talk about because, like, one of Iggy's ex-girlfriends, who was also very young, she said in interviews... Oh, it was different then.
Yeah.
It was different, which is something you can't always say. You can't always say those were the times.
Can't always say that, no.
And seeing how these men who were clearly having these women, girls,
yeah,
throwing themselves at them and them taking advantage of that, that is a tough thing to hear.
Yeah, it's just, that's something you got to face. You can't ignore this shit.
No. Like, as me, like, for example, like, as an individual, I have to decide whether I want to listen to the music or watch that show or that movie based on the information I have in front of me.
Yeah.
Well, was Iggy Pop a predator? No.
Yeah, it's not like he's R. Kelly.
But was he wrong? Yes.
Very much so.
Yeah. Yes.
Very, very much so.
Should he have gone to jail? Yeah.
Possibly.
Probably. Yeah. Probably should have gone to jail for that.
Yeah.
And honestly, we're leaving it up to you to decide.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that you have to think about with fucking... damn near every artist, you know? You have to decide. I know some people walk out of the fucking room when David Bowie starts playing because David Bowie was also guilty of doing this shit.
And we didn't play any Michael Jackson songs at our wedding. We requested no Michael Jackson songs.
Yeah, unfortunately, that now we have to do that. But our first dance was Rock and Roll with Me. So
there you go. Yeah. There you go. It's up to you to decide.
It's very much up to you. I think part of why they were all so into it has to do with the fact that, I mean, like I said in the first episode, and like even Iggy Pop himself said, musicians, especially like then, they can be like children. I mean, their emotional fucking quotient is quite low. I mean, Iggy Pop's maturity level at that time was probably hovering around 13 or 14 years old.
I agree with that, but it's still not an excuse.
It's not an excuse.
It's not an excuse.
No, absolutely.
We're going to trademark. It's not an excuse.
Both wearing t-shirts right now. It's not an excuse.
But, you know, when I wonder, like, why someone like Iggy would date someone so young, like, I can imagine that would be the reason, though.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the reason. It wasn't necessarily a sexual thing. Like, it wasn't necessarily a predator thing. It wasn't about power. It was about, oh, I can talk to this person. This person can talk to me on the same level, whereas someone that's my own age will not put up with me being... emotionally 13 years old.
Right. Nico was 10 years older than Iggy. She didn't last very long.
She did not last long at all. And the other part is, you know, it was like Iggy Pop's girlfriend said, even though it's not an excuse, it was socially acceptable for a man in his early 20s to date a teenage girl. I mean, Iggy had the approval of both of Betsy's parents. He actually went and asked them, like, is it cool if I date your daughter? I mean, it's partly because he wanted approval, but mostly because he didn't want to be arrested for transporting a minor across state lines.
It's those two things.
Yeah, and, you know, we're not justifying this at all, but as it is with the Nazi shit... while none of it looks good, it isn't as bad as it looks. In other words, like I said, Iggy Pop is not R. Kelly. He wasn't a predator. he was just super fucking scummy.
Yeah.
But while all this was going on, the Stooges were touring and trying to promote their debut. See, this was a weird time in rock and roll music, because a lot of established blues and soul singers were trying to recast themselves as psychedelic acts to keep up with the times. And when it worked, fuck, it worked.
Yeah.
Oh, it worked so well. It's like, just for example, like the Temptations went from singing pleasant but entirely unobjectionable songs like My Girl in 1965 to singing a song called You Make Your Own Heaven and Hell Right on Earth on an album called Psychedelic Shack just 5 years later.
Change. Life becomes a strange, confusing game. Suddenly you want the finer things in life, but you find it takes lots of hard work and sacrifice. Now you're standing at the crossroads of life
to satisfy your personal wants.
Will you do wrong or will you do right?
One thing you must admit, and you know it's true,
the final decision is still up to you. I'm telling you to let your facts for what it's worth.
Oh, now I want to listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Well, we can do that when we get home.
Yeah, I have a record.
Yeah, of course. No, we've got, we actually have quite a few Earth, Wind, and Fire records. But for every psychedelic shack, you had half a dozen other completely forgotten albums that now only exist in record collections and YouTube rips. Records like Chubby Checker Goes Psychedelic.
So that's not great.
I like it. I think it's pretty good. I think it's not bad. Like it's still like it's the guy from The Twist.
It is the guy from The Twist. Although he did make it number one in the dance charts
in
2008.
Really?
Yeah.
What for?
A song. I didn't write down. I don't remember.
You don't remember, but what that kind of album kind of reminds me of, like, it's the album that a record store employee is going to try to convince you is like a forgotten classic. Like, and that they're going to have it for like $60 behind the counter. And it's like, oh, Chubby Checker Goes Like That. It's like, oh, dude, you don't even know.
They don't even make these anymore. No, really, they don't.
No, they don't. It was released as, I think there was a CD reissue in like the early 2000s, I think, maybe the late 90s. But yeah, Chubby Checker Goes Psychedelic is, I mean, it's out there. And, you know, it's fine.
Good on Chubby Checker for trying that.
You know, good on Chubby Checker for trying. What this psychedelic wave meant was that in 1970, you could see a bill with Chubby Checker and the Stooges.
Cool.
Which must have been a fantastically weird fucking night. But oh God, that would have been so cool to see.
The psychedelic twist.
Now, after the experience the Stooges had with John Cale in recording their debut, particularly in the mixing phase, the question of who would produce their second album loomed large. But finally, they settled on Don Gallucci, whose biggest musical contribution up until that point had been playing keyboards on one of the Stooges' favorite songs when Don was just 15 years old. That song was Louie Louie.
You know, Don Gallucci is also Don. He's also from Don and the Good Times.
Who were Don and the Good Times?
They were a house band for like Dick Clark's like afternoon show that he had.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. So the reason why I mention this is because when they asked, like, what do you think of Don Gallucci as a producer? Ron and Scott, who are obsessed with watching TV, were like, oh my God. Don and the Good Times? Of course.
Yeah, of course we want to get produced by Don and the Good Times.
There's Louie Louie. Yeah, yeah, we like that too.
Yeah, but he's on TV.
Yeah.
Now, when Gallucci was in his mid-20s, about 10 years after Louie Louie, he started working at Elektra Records. And he had agreed to produce the Stooges' sophomore record, but he thought that getting the band down on tape was going to be fucking impossible.
Yeah, because Don Gallucci actually went to go see the Stooges.
Yeah.
He saw them play, and he calls up Jack Holtzman. He's like, yeah, this band is a great, great act, I guess. We're never going to get this on tape, though.
Yeah.
And Jack replied, you're already working for us, man.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Like, this is not an option. This is an assignment. Figure it out.
You're going to have to figure it out.
But the Stooges had learned a lot since the recording of the first album. Instead of just sort of making it up on the spot like they'd done before, the Stooges were actually crafting and developing songs. And these songs would eventually make up one of the best albums, not only of the decade, but probably one of the top 10 rock albums ever to be put on tape. That album was Funhouse.
Yeah!
Sexiest song ever.
It's so sexy.
Yeah, it's so fucking good. I can't believe he started writing that in his fucking closet.
No. I'm in here, Wendy. What is it?
And so the Stooges flew to Los Angeles on Iggy Pop's 23rd birthday and began recording.
Oh, funny little story. As soon as, like, the first day they got to L.A., Ron was walking down the street. And I guess he was, like, jaywalking or something, because there was a guy in a car who just slams on his brakes and goes, you fucking asshole! And then he looks and he sees it's John Wayne.
That's amazing.
He got called a fucking asshole by John Wayne on his first day. Sorry, continue.
I remember seeing Clancy Brown in line at Starbucks once in L.A. That was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Now, during the day, Iggy would spend all the daylight hours at the Tropicana and just take in the sun, and then start each afternoon with a tab of acid before going into the studio to record all night long.
Oh, yeah, that was when they were at the Tropicana. Andy Warhol was staying there, too. And he went up to the Stooges. He's like, hey, come up to my room. Come hang out. And the rest of the band was like, no. And Iggy just got up and was like, yeah, I'll hang out with Andy Warhol for a minute.
Yeah, Iggy Pop is definitely a man that personifies the power of yes.
Yeah. And then takes two drops of acid.
Now, as we know, acid was nothing new when it came to the Stooges, but it was during this time that the Stooges, and Iggy in particular, started picking up habits that would come to define and sometimes destroy the next decade of their lives. See, the band took a break from recording in July to do a show in San Francisco at the new Old Fillmore, and who should have been in the audience but a theater troupe called the Cockettes. And after the show, Iggy went to a party at the Cockettes' communal house. For the first time, it said that he tried heroin.
So this is in San Francisco, right, when they took their little break. And he was obsessed with this girl, Tina, there. And he's like, I want to have you. And she's like, ah, you better come with us then, because I'm not going with you.
It's smart.
Yeah, so he went over there, and he said the whole vibe in the whole house, it was so weird to him. He himself, he actually has not admitted that he tried heroin then.
Really?
Yeah, but there are plenty of sources that say that he did try. Even Tina herself said, like, I think we were the first ones who gave Iggy heroin.
Well, I mean, you know, they might, I don't know, they might be telling the truth, but they might also just enjoy the coolness of being like, yeah, I introduced Iggy Pop to heroin.
Exactly. But whatever happened, either way, it got into his mind, right? Yeah. And that was when the band, where they were at the Tropicana, everyone was getting to other things, like John Adams. We haven't mentioned John Adams until now.
Yeah.
He was there at the Tropicana, too. John Adams, he was an old friend of Jimmy Silver's. He was hired to be a roadie.
Mm-hmm.
And John introduced the band to coke because he used to be a drug addict. He was in recovery for many years.
And for heroin?
For heroin, yeah. So, but he decided to get into coke again. This guy, John Adams, they always called him the fellow.
Yeah, the fellow.
Yeah, he had a lot of nicknames like Flaps, Hippie Gangsta, Nichols, Peanut, the Sphinx, Goldie, the fellow. I mean, if you have a lot of nicknames, then you might have been a drug addict.
Yeah, no sober person gets nicknamed the Sphinx.
Nichols.
And actually around that time, yeah, like Jimmy Silver had a kid. So he dropped out, said, I can't be manager anymore. And John Adams replaced him as the Stooges' manager.
That's right, because while Jimmy Silver was in L.A. with them, he was getting more into macrobiotics rather than the rock and roll scene because he had a toddler, Rachel.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a hell of a lot more interested in encouraging the more debaucherous side of the Stooges than he was in advancing their career. And together, he and Iggy started heavily using cocaine in Los Angeles during the recording of Funhouse. And so the transfer from psychedelics to hard drugs began. But even in the midst of this, the output of the Stooges was still phenomenal. Rather than the near, you know, one-and-done style of the debut, the Stooges recorded Funhouse on a straight night-after-night grind, playing take after take after take until they finally came up with something they liked.
I wonder how they got to work so many long hours all the time.
And, you know, those of you who are absolutely insane about the Stooges, you probably already know that every single one of those takes was released a few years ago on a 7-CD box set.
Yeah, well, it's all on Spotify now.
Yeah, because the box set, when it originally came out, I think cost $600,
jeez,
$500.
Wow, yeah.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was a 7-CD box set, extremely limited edition. But yeah, but now, you know, everyone can hear it.
Yeah, and you know why they had to work harder on these takes, though? Because first they show up, and it's a really nice studio. Like, Jack Holtzman was like, no expense spared.
Yeah.
But the band were like, no, this is not going to work. I mean, what's up with all this baffling stuff over here?
Baffling?
What do we need that? We got to get rid of all this soundproofing. We got to make it like a live show.
We got to make this room sound like shit.
Yes. So they got all, like, they got rid of all the rugs and pillows, all that expensive shit that Jack Holtzman bought. They just threw it out. So Don Gallucci just let them set up the recording room just the way they liked it so they could do their live performance. So it's kind of like they wanted to show what they did on stage.
Yeah.
So Iggy actually even used a handheld microphone so he could dance and cavort around just singing the tracks into it. Like, they didn't even care. Like, the amp was in the room. So the noise or the instruments would bleed into one another, but they didn't care because they wanted it to sound raw.
And it did. This should not have worked.
Like, yeah. Once again, Iggy.
Yeah, like it really should not have worked. Now, if you so choose, you can go check out that 7-CD box set on Spotify. You can listen to 14 different takes of Down on the Street. You can listen to 28 takes of Loose, 15 takes of TVI. And while I haven't listened to all of it, I've definitely listened to more of it than I should have. Like I definitely spent more. I listened to more than I should have.
Are you okay?
But, you know, there are some actual gems to be found on there. See, if you listen to the raw versions of these songs, you can hear the influences a little more clearly. For example, if you listen to take 5 of TVI, which was originally titled See That Cat, it's the first line of the song.
Good change.
Well, you can hear that song better for what it is. In my opinion, TVI is the Stooges doing the MC5 better than the MC5 could do themselves.
You know what TVI stands for?
Twat vibe.
Twat vibe eye. That means like when you want to give someone the TVI, you're interested in having your twat vibing. Look at me, Marcus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, that was Kathy Ashton. She was the one that came up with that, right?
Yeah, Ron and Scott's sister. Yeah. She and her friends, they would come to shows all the time, and they'd always be like, I got a TVI on him. You know what I mean?
Well, the Stooges, during the recording of this album, they didn't lose their experimental edge. They still did some real weird shit with this album. On the almost 8-minute title track, the Stooges brought in a saxophone player named Steve McKay. Steve McKay's work was fantastic on this album, and it prefigured later punk and no wave acts like James Chance and X-Ray Specs.
Absolutely right. I remember hearing the saxophone on Bondage Up Yours.
Yeah. You know, it very much like is extremely, extremely influenced by that. You know the player in X-Ray Specs, the saxophone player? She was 15.
Whoa.
I think like 15 or 16. Yeah, because, you know, X-Ray Specs only had that one album.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, she was like, I got to go back to school now.
Oh, Lisa Simpson.
Jake!
McKay doing the saxophone work, he was doing heavy drugs with them too.
Yes.
He was just like laying on his back with his saxophone, playing as best he could. Well, I mean, really trying, really on drugs, because he was worried that he didn't know if he was going to be any good. Iggy Pop actually saw him perform before and then called him up and said, come to L.A. And Steve McKay was like, well, I got college exams next week. But you know what? You know what? I'll do them later. I will.
That's fucking insane that you could just that shit just used to happen. You know? It's like, OK, yeah, you're on one of the best rock records of all time just because you happen to play one weird little show in college. But even though the title track and the literally acid-fueled freak-out L.A. Blues showed how fucked up the Stooges were willing to get, the album, which clocks in at no more than 8 tracks, is full of seminal rock songs like Loose.
Now look out. I went down, baby, you can tell. I took a ride with a pretty music. Now I'm moving to you straight from the bed. Stick it deep inside. Stick it. Inside. Cause I'm loose. Always. I feel bad to be dancing, baby. I feel bad, I'm a shaking leaf. I feel bad to be dancing, baby. Love, yeah, I do believe. I'm sticking deep inside. I'm sticking deep inside. Cause I'm blues.
But unfortunately, Funhouse is kind of the end of the freewheeling good times for the Stooges.
No.
All that drug shit, like, starts off real fun. Always starts off real fun. It's like, man, I got this under control. I don't know what everyone's talking about. Man, what are they talking about? Like, everyone's talking about, like, getting addicted and, like, getting into, like, the depths of despair. Nah. We just recorded this great fucking album. Everything's going to be great from now on. I can just keep doing drugs and...
I can quit when I want to.
But although the Stooges were about to morph into the absolutely legendary live band they've come to be known as now that they truly had the songs, that reputation came, as all things do, with a price. And that is what we'll cover in the Stooges Part 3. And what we have with this episode, as with every episode, just go to my profile on Spotify and you'll find a playlist of all the songs that are available on the platform so you can maybe hear some new music that you haven't heard before.
Even Chubby Checker Go Psychedelic?
Nope.
Psychedelic? No, it's not on there? Why is it not on there?
Because the record company that owns the rights has not thought to put it online and submit it to Spotify.
Yeah, I'll make a call.
Yeah, you make a call. You let them know. All right. We'll see everybody next week. Thank you for listening.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Victoria.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah. feel it? Say, do you feel it when you touch me? Say, do you feel it when you touch me? There's a fire. There's a fire. Yeah, alright. Inside.